Hello, everybody. Today we have Sherry Strong, and she's a food philosopher. Sherry, what does this mean?
Well, in Australia, when I would call myself a food philosopher, the first thing that would come to people's mind was wanker. They thought it was a very ostentatious kind of term, and some people just think it's kind of marketing hype, but the truth is I've actually developed philosophies that help us develop a healthier relationship with food, our body, and the environment. And so it's a more conceptual approach to actually developing a healthy relationship with food rather than a nutritional dissecting, you know, scientific approach.
So give us sort of a general outlay on what the philosophies are that you teach,
yeah,
so that we can, you know, one by one try and dissect.
Yes. Well, essentially, I believe what's actually happened to our food is that we've processed it in such a way, very similar to how we actually take opium sap and turn it into heroin, very similar to how we take coca leaves and turn it into cocaine. Not us specifically, but humans, right? Okay. And in that processing, we can actually take these foods and make them just as addictive and toxic to the body. They have different types of addiction, but they do create a drug-like intoxication. And sometimes it's not like we're hanging out in a backstreet alley, but when it comes to the lethal recipe that I talk about, we don't have to hang out in a backstreet alley because it's available on almost every street corner, and it's legal, and it's cheap, and it's socially acceptable. And the lethal recipe primarily, there's many ingredients that are processed this way, but primarily it's refined sugars, refined oils, refined salts, refined grains, and refined chemicals. In their natural state, when we had to actually source them ourselves in nature, the actual ability to source it restricted our consumption if we were sourcing it ourselves.
Tell us more about this. What is this? You know, everybody talks about refined. What is this? What is this? What are we refining? What is the process?
Yeah, well, just like, so in order to make opium from opium sap, in its natural state, opium sap is neither addictive or toxic to the body. It has opiates in it, which gives you a sense of well-being, gives you a good feeling, just like there's opiates in wheat and dairy. Okay, so there's opiates in it. But in its natural state, there's literally thousands of other naturally occurring plant chemicals, vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, fiber in it. So in its whole and intact state, when it enters into the body, it gives a little kind of rush of well-being. And in fact, at funerals in Iran, they actually take the powdered opium sap and they sprinkle it into teas. Okay, so not highly addictive or toxic. But the process of actually making it, and this is very similar to how we actually process, you know, these ingredients I call, you know, part of the lethal recipe, is they start to use heat. And heat, we know, with any living food, it denatures it. So there's less nutrients in there that the body actually, you know, can deal with or can actually extract from it. Then what they do is they start to, with the heat, they cut it with toxic chemicals, again, changing its molecular structure. And then they start to remove the macro and micronutrients. So if you've ever seen videos of them making opium, it looks like this big cauldron, it's like a stock pot, and they're just gleaning the top off the stock, right? And what they're actually taking off the top, the refining process, is in metals, in the metal industry, if we were refining gold or silver, they call it impurities. Even when you're making an animal stock, you know, they take off what they call the impurities. Well, the impurities in these processes are actually macro and micronutrients, powerful living plant chemicals that actually are nourishing, energizing, and protective to the body. And the more pure a substance is, so if you actually, opium is less pure than heroin, right? Okay, cocaine is a pure white substance. Heroin's pure white substance. Refined sugar, pure white substance, okay? So what they're doing is they're removing all the macro and micronutrients that actually make that food nourishing, energizing, and protective. And in changing its molecular structure, it's making it more addictive. Now, the absence of all those phytochemicals means that the bodies can actually eat a volume of food, but when it's processed this way, because the things that actually shut off our satiety cue in nature, our nutrients.
Satiety cue.
Satiety cue. So the cue that actually says, I'm full, I've had enough. Okay, I've had enough is probably more the correct term, because we don't actually have to fill up our whole tummy in order to be nourished. But what's happened in our society is because our foods had all the macro and micronutrients taken out of it, the body is waiting for it to be satiated, to actually be nourished. And so it just says, keep eating, feed me more, I'm not getting what I need, right? So then what happens is we as a society have got used to having a full belly, and that's what we just get used to, that level of comfort, because that means we've had enough food, when in fact we've had too much of a volume of food that's nutrient deficient. So thus we get this kind of cycle, a vicious cycle, because the food's addictive. We get the drug-like intoxication, and then we get the low. And in the low, we seek foods that are giving us a corresponding high. And so we're just eating more in this vicious cycle to actually... And in truth, we're actually... most of us are malnourished when we're eating this lethal recipe.
That's why we have obesity right now?
Absolutely, yeah. Because these people are actually malnourished. They're hungry because their bodies aren't actually being nourished, because the nutrients, the nourishing parts of the food, have actually been processed out.
I thought it was that because we were sitting in front of the television or the monitors, and kids, you know, are eating all this salty, sweet.
Yes, but they're not eating broccoli. If they sat in front of a monitor and just ate raw broccoli, I promise you the situation would be very different. And one of the examples I give to people in my classes is I show them, I say, here's a bowl of broccoli. You know, let's say it's, you know, about a 16-ounce bowl of broccoli. And I say, how long would it take you to sit down and eat that broccoli, just as it is, no dip, no sauce or anything like that? And usually I get anywhere from half hour to 45 minutes to some people saying never. Okay. But as soon as I cook that broccoli and I ask them, the time literally halves or goes into a quarter, right? Because as soon as we cook something, we change its structure, we diminish the nutrients, and we actually make it more addictive, because it's nature's protective way, or evolutionary way of protecting the species, is saying if it's diminished in nutrients, the body automatically will want and crave more.
Yeah, because, you know, when I talk with kids and I observe what they're eating, I usually, if you say something like, eat a bowl of broccoli, they say, well, yuck, you know, we're not going to do that. Let's go for an ice cream, or let's go for something sweet. And that for me, it's shocking that we're not able to train our kids into thinking healthy.
So what's actually happening with children is it's quite innocent. They're just following their evolutionary urges. We're actually given stronger physiological compulsions for these foods that are in ice cream. So there's opiates in ice cream. You know, there's refined sugar in ice cream. So these are drugs to the body, right? Okay, so if you're going to give them a choice between raw broccoli and ice cream, in evolutionary terms, it's a no-brainer, right? So broccoli has naturally occurring chemicals, but there's nothing addictive in it. Nothing highly addictive, right? When people get addicted to broccoli, it's a psychological addiction. what they're addicted to is that true sense of well-being, but it's not a drug-like addiction, okay? So, and what happens, too, is with the kids, you know, it's giving them a stronger, like, drug stimulus, right, where the broccoli's not making them feel good beyond that. So if we kind of go beyond the lethal recipe, and this is, if we look at how, again, I'm going to say refined sugars, refined oils, refined salts, refined grains, and refined chemicals are put into our food. Anytime you take any food, whether it's a plant or an animal substance, and you process it, you take it to a where it changes its reaction in the body, and it becomes, the more it's processed, or the more it's actually farther away from nature, the more the body actually wants more of it, because it's saying, feed me more, I'm not getting what I need. You diminish it.
Okay.
So that's the lethal recipe. That's kind of the first philosophy that I teach. And then I teach another philosophy that helps people understand what it is we're meant to be eating, called nature's principle, which is nature tells us what to eat and the quantities to eat it, and by how easily it's obtained in nature. So that which is most abundant in nature, we're meant to have the most of. Harder to obtain in nature, we're meant to have less of it, and we're given stronger physiological desires to work for it. And in the balance of working for those foods harder to obtain, we actually work off the energy, so there's no obesity in nature. There never has been. It's only when we actually deviated from nature that we can actually create obesity. And this, just one, the last group is, if you cannot get it in nature, not only do we not need it, it's harmful to the body and the environment.
If we do not get it in nature...
If we can't find something in nature, if a food does not exist in nature, we don't need it. and so if we're eating something that doesn't exist in nature, so a man-made concoction that's so far away from nature, we don't need it, the body doesn't need it, and it's actually going to be harmful for the body and the environment. And there's a universal axiom in that, in what I believe is that if it's bad for the planet, it's bad for the body, and if it's bad for the body, it's bad for the planet. And I've not seen an example yet that actually defies that.
Before we go further, I'd like to know more about why did you, you know, so that my listeners, a lot of them are women, that they understand why did you choose this path? You know, like we have this sort of thought pattern, women, kitchen, and all of that. Why did you choose that path rather than becoming an actress or going into the film world or being a writer or being a philosopher?
Well, it's interesting because I think everything that I do today encompasses all of those things. So I get to write, I get to perform when I'm speaking professionally, you know, in on stage and on television. But the how I actually came to what I'm actually specifically doing around food philosophy is that I actually had a very unhealthy relationship with food for most of my life. And I really believe that that was set in motion at birth, where I was one of these children whose mother was convinced by doctors and nurses that this new baby formula they had come out with was actually better for her baby than breast milk. So this the ego of man to suggest that he'd actually improved on nature, and that there was actually, in fact, my mother actually recounts a story about how she was made to feel dirty for breastfeeding her first two children by the nurses. And so when it came to having me and this formula, and she was very intimidated by the medical world, she chose to feed me formula. And at that time in the 60s, baby formula still had excitotoxins or neurotoxins in it. So it actually had the lethal recipe. It had refined sugars, refined oils, refined grains, refined salts, and refined chemicals, including MSG, which is now illegal to have, you know, in food. It's an excitotoxin. And for a little baby where the blood-brain barrier has not been fully formed, it actually creates a toxic environment in the body. And as a result, I was a sickly baby. And at 2 months old, I was hospitalized and almost died. And was always cranky, was always upset. In hindsight, I actually believe it's because I was malnourished. And so I think probably it set up in motion with me this feeling of wanting around food. And I was always interested in food and taste and flavor. I just remember being absolutely fascinated by it, whether it was, you know, things that had refined sugar in it, or when I had these very interesting experiences where I had very small windows of seeing natural food preparation. Because most of the food that I grew up with came out of packets and boxes, and there was a few bits of vegetables that came out of tins that were overcooked, you know, peas that were already overcooked in a tin and then they were boiled again, and or way overcooked meat and things like that. So when I did have a rare experience of real food, it was just, I was incredibly fascinated by it. I mean, even not so natural, as a child, an Easy Bake Oven was this little oven you could make cakes in. And I remember thinking that was the best thing in the whole world. And I wanted to cook with my mother, but she at that time didn't have the patience. So she would actually set me up on the island or the kitchen countertop, and she'd say, "You can help me by watching." And I remember as a child being incredibly frustrated and thinking, "I don't want to watch, I want to cook." And so I would actually wake up in the wee hours in the morning, literally when it was dark out, and I would sneak into the kitchen and I would start to cook things. And I'd put things on pots and I'd make like Jell-O brand gelatin in a bowl, which I was very proud of at 5 that it actually set. Unfortunately, it was in a bowl that had raw chicken in it the night before, so we couldn't eat it. But I burnt toast and, you know, all kinds of things. But I remember actually seeing the kitchen as this place of magic would actually happen and alchemy would happen, which, you know, we know culinary alchemy does happen.
Was one thing I wanted to get back, today's women who are giving birth and are breastfeeding, they're, what I've heard, I don't know whether this is true, but I've heard that there is substances in the breast milk, things like putrine or something, which is coming from the aeroplanes that are discharging or burning their gas, and that we're breathing that in and it's going into the milk of the women who are then feeding the kids. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, there's no doubt that breast milk is compromised by the fact that our environment is bringing toxins into the body. And we know that even before they're actually, you know, breastfeeding, that children are actually born, there's literally dozens of chemicals, you know, in the umbilical cord, you know, that babies are not without toxins in it. Saying that formula would be a good alternative to that is still not a really good idea, because any milk that you're getting it from would be compromised for the very same reasons. There's just going to be a different variation of toxins that actually enter into the system. So, and just as a mother has severely compromised diet, obviously her breast milk is not going to be of a great quality. So there's many, many factors that go into it. It's not a yes or no kind of question.
Because, right? You know, I mean, I've also understood that the immune system that kids develop, it comes from the mum's milk, the placenta, all of these things. It actually is a great aid. What I liked about what you were speaking about was this magic in the kitchen.
Mm.
What is this magic? How have you now discovered, let's say, today's world, what have you discovered that is magical?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you come back to that, because I think this is really compelling for a lot of people, and we've lost it. We used to think that a recipe, you just add A, B, and C, and the magic actually happened maybe when we were baking, where there was actually some kind of chemistry involved. But the truth is that, and we've known it for thousands of years, you know, and many cultures have actually revered the act of actually making food with the presence of love and the intention, the sincere and well-intentioned ways you actually prepare the food, actually manifest in the food. And I just have that much experience, and I've seen it that many different times, that it's not an intellectual concept for me anymore. It's a knowing. It's a place that actually I've integrated my instinct, my intuition, with the intellect around it, and it's just becomes this knowing that when we actually source food from, you know, good quality farmers, you know, farmers who actually farm from an ideological viewpoint rather than just for money, and you actually are grateful for the farmer actually providing this food, which to me, the farmers should be given the significance of the CEOs in this world or celebrities, because they're doing the most amazing job on the planet for us, particularly the ones who are actually doing it for the right reasons. So you take their food and you actually prepare it. You prepare it with love. And then there's obviously a myriad of different combinations. I can give 10 students in my classes the exact same ingredients with the exact same recipe, and I promise you I will get 10 different variations of the recipe. And it would be impossible to actually, you know, say everyone create the exact same flavor with it. It's extraordinary. And it comes down to, you know, how someone stirs something, the intention, the fear. Are they actually afraid of getting it wrong? Or are they just so excited and in love with the process? You can taste that in the food.
It sort of reminds me of, you know, like, your mom's food is the best food. You know, like, I've talked with so many people, and they say how my mom makes it, it's the best, right? And I think it's the love that they put into it, mm-hmm. and that you as a child get used to this, mm-hmm. and sense it, mm-hmm. That it's there. That's a nice thought. Can we get into addictions?
Mm. So to talk a bit about addictions, I started about it with the lethal recipe, because I showed you how actually food is made. Just Scripps Institute and Rodale Institute have done 4-year studies that have confirmed that refined sugar is as addictive as cocaine and heroin. And anyone who's had sugar addiction, addiction to refined sugar, and has tried to come off of it, knows that it is really hard to actually beat. So if you actually look in the natural world, addiction was not a huge problem. Addiction only became a huge problem in our society when we started to process and refine things. Because every traditional culture would have something that they smoked, would have something, you know, fermented beverage that they would drink, right? Because they sourced that in a natural context, the actual act of actually creating it limited their consumption. So the consumption concept is one of the philosophies that I teach, which basically the premise of it is if you had to source your own food in nature, you, as an individual, you would never become obese, number one. Okay, just, it couldn't happen. Because in order to actually source something in nature, the things that are actually making us obese now are things that we would have to work off the equivalent energy in nature to actually get. And one of the best...
Can I just interrupt? One thought, you know, like, you're talking about refined sugars, mm-hmm. Then a lot of people ask me, says, well, what should I take? And I say, well, maybe stevia, maybe honey. Is that an alternative to refined sugar?
Well, there's refined stevia and there's natural stevia. So the green stevia is natural and the white stuff is refined. Okay, so xylitol is another one of those sugars that they say because it's, you know, it doesn't spike the blood sugars, it's good for you. When in fact, it's actually made from wood. You know, it's made from wood pulp and it's highly refined. It goes through at least 14 different processes. It's a chemical. It's not a naturally occurring sugar. By the time you actually consume it.
Honey?
Raw, pure honey is definitely a pure thing, but our consumption of it was limited in nature by the fact that it had, you know, bees around it. And we had to actually fight them for their own food. And there was, when we ate in a natural context, we were really respectful that, that food was actually food for the colony. And we were actually taking part of that. And so we actually had to develop a strategic relationship with the bees in order to do that.
Because in Tibet, you know, while we were filming around the world, and some of the monks would laugh, you know, when I take honey with everything. And I would put honey in my coffee and honey in my tea. And they would say, it's like, it's not good for you. The medicine men of Tibet would come up and they would smile, you know, and they would say that this is not good. And I said, why? He says, because when you're heating the honey, it makes you tired and lazy. Mm. Is this true?
Well, I think that if you have natural honey, no matter what it is, it's going to spike your blood sugars, even if it's raw and pure. I think, obviously, again, remember, heat denatures the nutrients, so it increases our consumption of it. But even if it's raw and pure, in a natural palate, if you actually, because our palates as a culture have been way too acclimated to high sugar. You know, it's very rare that someone who's grown up in a natural environment could eat more than a teaspoon of honey because it's just so full on and it's full of nutrients. Whereas now, because of the way we're refining it, and one of the examples I give to people is if anyone's ever had fresh cane juice, you can drink about a glass of it and your body just goes no more, right? But if you take the same sugar and you refine it and put it in a soft drink, people can drink up to 2 liters of it, right? You know, over a period of an evening. You see, when it has nutrients in it, the body side shuts off. As soon as we heat and change its molecular structure, we can drink a lot more of it. So just going back to the consumption concept and how we would eat in a natural environment if we had to source our things ourselves, just something as simple as chocolate cake, I say to people, how much chocolate cake would you eat in a year? Say it's something that you enjoy. Well, most people could eat a slice a week. Right. If you ask most people who like chocolate cake, that would be easy. Or maybe you have a different sweet, a choice that you can have. And then I say, so imagine trying to source this in nature and making a chocolate cake from scratch. So growing the wheat, harvesting the wheat, threshing the wheat, separating the grain from the husk, right? And then grinding it, and then taking out the bran and the germ, which is what most people, when they have chocolate cake in this country, do. They're not having whole wheat flour. And then you have to go to South America, and you go and grab the cacao beans, and you treat them, and you break them open, and you crush them, and you powder them, right? And then you grab some vanilla beans, which actually take about a year to grow. So it's not something that you can just have on tap all the time. You grab your vanilla beans. And then you go to the cow, and you milk the cow, and you churn the butter. And I say, you'd work off way more calories in nature making that thing than you ever would eating it. Mm. And when you eat it, when you finally gather all of those things together, and that's just part of the process, and you actually physically put it together and bake it, and that would be a very natural cake, very different to how most chocolate cakes are made today. You would savor every single bite, and you would appreciate all the resources that were required for the planet to bring that together, the human resources to bring it together. And there's a corresponding equivalent of the resources that are required by your body to then break it down.
All right. Health relationship to food. Mm.
For them to be healthy, they actually need to start to develop a healthier relationship with food and their body and the environment. And there's a connection between all of them. We've been eating as a human, which we have somehow evolved to think that we're no longer a mammal or an animal. And if we want to start to eat healthily, we need to integrate our head, which most people are making decisions intellectually around their food. And it's all based on nutrient panels and recommended daily intakes, you know, all these kinds of things that are not natural, right? So as I often say, the healthiest, longest living, thriving cultures on the planet have no idea what the recommended daily intake of vitamin C is. They have no idea how many grams of protein to carbs or ratios or anything like that. They eat in context of a natural environment, right? That which is the most abundant, they have the most of. And if it's harder to obtain, they have less of it, right? So if you think about it, there's a hierarchy within nature that actually tells us what we're meant, what is good for us. And it starts out with the most basic nutrient we're most life dependent on. So the nutrient we can't survive seconds without is air, and it's everywhere. The nutrient you can't survive days without is 70% of the water. 70% of your body composite is water, right?
Right.
Okay, so you see there's a hierarchy. Then we know we're meant to eat greens. Vegetation is probably the third most big source of nutrients for the human species. But even amongst that, there's actually a hierarchy of what we're meant to be eating. So we're meant to be eating more vegetables than fruits because there are more species of vegetables. They grow faster. They're at their most powerful and delicious and nutritious when they're young. And as they age, they diminish in nutrients. They're not as palatable, and they become more fibrous, harder to eat. Whereas fruit, if I plant a broccoli seed, I can have broccoli sprouts in days, and I can have broccoli in a few months. If I plant an apple seed, how long does it take me before I can enjoy an apple from that? Years, right? Okay, but even then, we don't just eat a piece of fruit when it grows to maturity and pick it off the tree because it's still green and bitter and unpalatable, right? We wait until it ripens. So it's nature's way of saying, have lots of this down close to the ground while you're waiting for this, and this will be your dessert. And in the ripening process is where most of the nutrients are actually infused into the fruit, and why when we eat it, it's not just the sugars that have actually developed. There are phytochemicals and vitamins and minerals that are actually infused in the ripening process. So when you're eating it, you're getting the delight of the sugars being developed, which is one way, nature's way of saying wait for this. But you're also getting the sense of well-being that comes because there's more nutrients in that food, which is why most of that fruit that's in the major supermarkets that's been picked before it's ripened doesn't give you the sense of well-being. It's why many people, when I ask them, have you ever eaten an apple and felt like it was hard work, like you're thinking I'm eating this because it's good for me, but I don't really feel like it and it doesn't taste like much, compared to those who have actually eaten an organic or biodynamic apple off the tree that's been ripened by the sun, you know, and they taste it, and it's just so amazing, it's delicious. There's a different experience. So as we start to move back to developing a more natural relationship with food and understanding how food works, when people tell me that organics are no higher in nutrients or it doesn't make a difference, they're basically telling me they don't understand the physiology, the biology, the natural cycle, how actually a plant's made. Because if you understand how a plant is actually made and how the nutrients are infused into the plant, and how we, in turn, when we eat those foods, are nourished by it, they just don't understand how nature actually works. And once you actually understand it, and I can teach children this, where they can actually understand the difference of how a plant actually gets nutrients in it and how conventional farming completely diminishes that. So it's about going back to a natural relationship with food.
Before we get into your books, I'd like to ask you one question. What is happening in our planet today? When I'm in sort of circles today of meetings and networking, so many people have cancer and are diseased.
Yeah.
Are these people not understanding the nutrition part, or is there something in our bodies that are just waiting to come out?
Well, there's many factors, but basically cancer and all these diseases are imbalances, right? So it's not just always nutrition that triggers an imbalance, but it's usually often related, you know. And what I find is it's not always that, you know, so you're eating bad food and you've got cancer. It's usually because there's an emotional reason that you're engaging in a behavior that's producing imbalance.
Right.
So that's kind of how I actually work and believe around those things.
Okay. Break. Hello everybody, I'm Iqbal. Do you feel stressed? Do you feel tired? Are you having difficulty focusing, can't relax, brain chatter, need an audio sleep aid? Go to
iqbalance.com. And your audio download solutions are all there on the online store. Just click on store. Thank you. Welcome to Block Talk Radio IQ Live.
So tell us more about your books. Okay. What is it that if people want to know what you're writing about and how they can get hold of it, basically right now, what are you writing about?
Well, it's interesting because for the last, since 1993, I've been teaching cookery and healthy living, that kind of thing. And I've written this book called Return to Food, How Going Back is the Way Forward. I don't believe the solution lies in science. I actually believe it goes, our solution, and this is, you know, sacrilegious in a culture that worships science, but I actually believe that the solution lies in going back to how we actually naturally procured and had a relationship with food. So the book, it's something I've illustrated, so I have illustrations that support the point, and there's obviously a philosophical approach to it. There's a little bit of my own story, and how I actually went from being twice my size to being half my size, through developing a natural relationship with food and stopping dieting, because dieting is a disordered relationship with food. It's not natural. And now what I'm probably more writing about and speaking about is something I call holistic entrepreneurship. And what I realized a few years back, people were always coming up to me as I was speaking and saying, how do I do what you do? Where do I go and study to do what you do? And I would always say, well, there is no institution that teaches what I do. It's a hybrid. I've just developed it. And but now I've actually developed the Javala Holistic Culinary Academy and Entrepreneurship Program, where I'm actually teaching people how to teach this to other people, because I can't do this on my own. And this message, the planet needs it, and the humans on this need it, on the planet need this, and all those animals that are being treated unnaturally need us to get out and actually show people how to fall in love with plant foods. And so the entrepreneurship program is something that I've developed to actually come into Javala and teach people how to cook holistically, to speak powerfully, because it's really important once you start a business in the holistic space to be able to communicate your brand and to speak powerfully about it, and to make money authentically. So one of the phrases that I use is that I actually help people to achieve freedom and to make money by being the change, so profit from being the change in the world that they wish to see. Because one of the things that in this whole holistic space is a lot of people have had a poverty mentality. And I believe that in order for us to actually change the planet at the speed in which we need it, we need to equip as many light workers or people who are actually wanting to do good in the world with the resources to be able to do that. And abundance is a place where we're actually going to create much more rapid change than if we're just trying to figure out where our rent's coming from because we're wanting to do good in the world. And I think once we change that paradigm and people can actually see that they can actually live abundantly. And when I say abundantly, I don't mean driving flashy cars, you know, and jetting off around the world. I just mean as in the things that you need that make you feel good, that actually take care of the things that truly make you happy and healthy, are taken care of. And that you can actually create and help people and be of service from that space rather than, I don't know where my rent's coming from space.
I'd like to change a little bit. We have 8 minutes left. Children's nutrition. Mm-hmm. How can we teach children to become more aware of nutrition, or what's the journey? What can we do to help kids?
Well, the first thing is we need to parent. And what's happening now is so many people have stopped parenting in the sense that the children are actually in charge. And a colleague of mine, Kathy Lynn's, written a book called Who's in Charge Anyway? And I think a lot of the children's nutrition has actually has evolved in a very unhealthy way because we've asked children what they want to eat, rather than understanding that if you ask a child what they want to eat, based on their physiology, once they're addicted to this lethal recipe, we're not going to get the answer that's actually going to be the healthiest and most powerful for them. So we need to actually take charge to start with. And I know that's that can be really confronting. I often say to people that when you're childless, the best parenting experts in the world are those people without children. And I kind of say that tongue-in-cheek, but because often people, when I start to talk, will say, well, do you have children? Do you know how hard it is? And I say, no, unfortunately, I wasn't able to have children, and I don't know how hard it is. But there's a perspective that people without children can actually give you, and there's observations that I can actually see happening, that maybe if you have a child and you're involved in this struggle to actually get them to eat well, that you can't really see in the moment.
Yeah, because you want to, as a father, I wanted to please my child.
Yes.
But then I also noticed that I would not buy her ice cream from one of the shops, and she would get really angry with me. Mm-hmm. And I would just think to myself, you know what? I'm sorry, but this is one of the things that you have to understand, that this is not going to help you right now as we're traveling around the world.
Yeah.
This is not going to help you, but let's eat some other foods.
Yeah.
And she got used to this, you know, this way I was treating her, that I wasn't going to invite her for this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's easy to get hold of,
yeah.
and it makes them happier. But I was thinking, you know what? I've learned from my parents that that comes last.
Yeah.
First you eat properly, and then comes the dessert.
And it's a short-term gain. So you'll only keep them very happy for a very short period of time until their blood sugars go all wacky and they become, you know, imbalanced, right? So with children, one of the big things is that we actually have to develop a healthy relationship with food, and we have to get excited and fall in love with plant foods. And I promise you, when you actually start to do this and you do it from a place of love, I've seen so many people, you know, put in front of their children healthy food, and it's almost like, you know, they're going, oh, will they eat it? Won't they eat it? Oh, please eat it, because I don't want you to die. You know, that's not actually feeding your child from a place of love, right? That's fear. Yeah. You're feeding them. And children sense that's fear.
Absolutely.
And they also sense when they're being manipulated or controlled. And they also know when there's boundaries set and I have a choice to eat this or I go hungry. Very few children in the world that we're living in where this is an issue actually go hungry. They actually can be fed a lot of food and be malnourished. And you know, it's interesting because one of the pictures I show people, I show them the series of images from The Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, where there's a very effective image. Depending on how much packaged food is on a table can often relate to that country's lifestyle diseases. And there's one picture that's quite startling because there's a woman in a refugee camp in Chad in Africa, and she has a few little bits of grains and some pulses and seeds, and her children have the most beautiful skin, beautiful teeth, they're slender, they're not actually malnourished, but they're certainly not carrying extra weight. And when I gave my TED talk in 2009, I actually said, I wonder if this woman, when she puts the plates of food in front of her children, says, don't worry about what you're eating, kids. Don't worry about finishing what's on your plates, because there's obese kids in America. And I said, before you think I might be a little bit cavalier about children going hungry, which is not funny, we've reached a critical time in humanity where 27,000 people are dying every day. Children are dying every
27,
day.
27,000?
Are dying a day due to starvation.
Whoa, okay.
But 42,000 children are dying every day due to complications that relate to this lethal recipe, where they're actually getting a volume of food that's toxic and addictive and being malnourished. And so the diseases that we see are literally filling up children's hospitals are related to this lethal recipe. So if we want to start to feed children well, first we must lead by example and start to develop a healthy relationship with food. Then we need to actually set boundaries around what's happening. And the third piece, I think, is the most powerful, is when we start to grow things ourselves or take kids to farmers markets and we prepare food with them in the kitchen together. And they're involved in the process, the decision-making process as far as creating the food. And that's where I see the most significant changes happening to the relationship with food and children's health.
So developing a relationship with our food.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you, Sherry.
My pleasure.
Hi, I'm Iqbal. You know, it's just a thought. I mean, where are our children going to play if we keep polluting this planet, Earth? Enjoy. I've seen a lot of shut down thinking there. Some even say you just delay, 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 repel. The winds are blowing there, winds are blowing where. You see the trees fly up in the air. Hurricanes are there, hurricanes are everywhere. You know now what I mean. Uh-huh. But tell me.
Have a great day wherever you are in the world.